Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. Welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. This is episode 203, and on this week's episode of the podcast, I will be reviewing The Punisher, One Last Kill. But I will not be alone. I will be joined by friend of the show, Andy Babacht. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, how's everyone doing? Listening wherever you are in the world.
Andy, this is exciting. This is the first Marvel project we've had you on for.
Yes. And
I feel like maybe you've looked at this project quite extensively for some random reason. What would that be?
Yeah, what Kyle is alluding to so casually, and for you, those of you listening, so The Punisher, One Last Kill, as some of you may not know, I am a senior staff writer for Screen Rant, where our good buddy Rob Keith is at. Shout out to you, Rob, if you're listening. And I was given the chance to do my first review for Screen Rant because I have mainly been on news since like late 2019 when I first joined. And now, I've done features, I've done interviews, and now I got a chance to finally do a review, and it just happened to be Punisher, which I was very excited about. And so it got me, it led to some fun things I wasn't expecting, but it makes the experience even more special for sure.
Well, I'm really excited for us to chat about Punisher Last Kill, but as listeners of the podcast will know, that's going to be the main focus of this. After Andy and I are done talking about Punisher Last Kill, I'm going to give my thoughts on a couple other series that I just haven't had the chance to. So all the time codes are going to be listed for all those different reviews in the episode description. All of these are going to be full spoilers. You've had the opportunity to watch all of these things because by the time you're listening to this, Last Kill's been out since Tuesday evening. So we're going to dive full spoilers into The Punisher, One Last Kill.
Reports link former veteran turned vigilante Frank Castle, aka The Punisher, as the main culprit behind these murders, after it was alleged that the Nucci's were one of the last criminal organizations linked to his family's death. Frank Castle's whereabouts remain unknown.
Now, Andy, I'm not going to let you not talk about it because I think it's the best place to start. You tweeted about this. Your pull quote from your review, which was John Bernthal was born for this role, got used by Marvel Studios. So if anybody doesn't know what that means, you also didn't listen to the Daredevil Born Again Season 2 episode with Jedi Mike, because Jedi Mike also got pull quoted for the Devil Wears Prada 2.
Hell yeah, Mike.
This is why the podcast slogan still stands, and I'm not going to hear anything about that. Andy, so obviously you were invested in the release of this because professionally it's an incredible accomplishment and very proud of my friend.
Oh, thank you.
But I haven't read your review. I may have seen the star score. Why don't you give your general thoughts on The Punisher, One Last Kill?
Yeah, I will say that, Punisher, when The Punisher came into the MCU back in 2016, whenever it was, I always thought he was a great supporting character, but I was never sure about how I felt him being a leading character. I had my ups and downs with the Netflix show for the two seasons that it ran. But I've always stood by the fact that John Bernthal is one of the perfect castings for comic book media. Think of it this way. What Robert Downey Jr. is to Tony Stark, what Iman Balani is to Ms. Marvel, is what John Bernthal is to Frank Castle and Punisher. And I also feel like, given the political climate we're in right now, I think that it's also it's complicated, I think, to utilize Punisher because what some people are using his logo for, which they're completely misunderstanding the purpose, and which even Born Again touched upon. But Frank Castle, John Bernthal has always been something where if you're gonna show him more of him, I'm here for it. I'm not gonna necessarily be no, I don't want any more. He is someone who is worth being on screen. It's just a matter of how, when, and why. And I think this special presentation with One Last Kill is a perfect example of how to give us Punisher where it doesn't feel too little or too much. My only issue with the special is that this special presentation was too short, but I think this is still like having a self-contained, just full story that is, you know, for at least 40 minutes focusing on Frank, I think is still perfect. And again, because the one of the rare things with this offshoot is the fact that John also co-wrote it with the director who did this. And I feel like I feel like John Bernthal doesn't get enough credit for the creativeness that he brings behind the scenes of things that he works on. Like, he's not only is he a phenomenal character, chameleon actor, whatever you want to call it, because like sometimes I forget that it's an actor playing a character because that's how well he does it. And but in this case, you know, he really, and he's shown this in so many interviews and conventions over the years, that this is a character that that is near and dear to him. And this, you know, One Last Kill really showcases that and reminds us, that's why I said in my review, like, it's a reminder of why he was born to play this character, because it's not an easy role. It's on the surface, many might think, oh, but he's just someone who shoots a lot of people. He's a, you know, gritty anti-hero. On the surface, yes, that's what he is. But there are so many complex layers to him. And this can go for, you know, if you read him in the comics, if you've seen him in other media adaptations, like, this isn't just someone just runs around and shoots bad guys and whoop they do. Like, no, there is so much trauma, so much damage to him. And this installment, you know, episode of, you know, mini movie, whatever you want to call it, because I still really don't really know where to put these special presentations at. But this was such a good character study of who Frank Castle is, where he's been at, where he is now, and where he is going.
I agree with a lot of that. I think what's most, and this is a compliment while also being a criticism, is this feels like a pilot for the Punisher show that Disney Plus probably is never going to make, particularly in the way that this story focuses obviously substantially on Frank's trauma, which it's funny because this character, at least in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, has gotten a lot of play. Of course, introduced notably in Daredevil Season 2, the better half of that season, and then wound up getting his own series for two seasons, and then was notable in the creative shift that saved Daredevil Born Again from being essentially a rebootquel. And those scenes are fantastic. And the dynamic of specifically Daredevil, Karen Page, and Frank showing how their history has changed, kind of where they are since we saw them all in the Netflix era of that. And the length of this is a real problem for me because there are clear, I would say not budgetary cuts, but quite literally, if you only have what is actually about 47 minutes of actual screen time, you have to trim a lot down. And a lot of this really works for me. I like the idea of showing Frank at this broken phase of his life after the events of Daredevil Born Again. You saw at the post-credit scene of season one that he escaped. John Bernthal as an actor has always been the best version of this character, even on his introduction in Born Again season, or not Born Again, in Daredevil season two. Just that manic person dealing with so much trauma and the way that it sort of explodes out of him and his way in dealing with all of that, those issues, is through the violent acts and thinking he's making things better because of his experiences. And John continuously, every time he's shown up as that character, I thoroughly enjoy his portrayal of it. We know I'm not going to bury the lead. We've all seen the Spider-Man Brand New Day trailer. We know he's going to be back. And where that leads, I think what's really interesting more than anything is the initial marketing for this, like One Last Kill. This isn't his last kill. Like, there's the way that this is set up, we're in full spoilers. Like, the inciting incident is something that is only shown on a news broadcast that he killed the most of the last family, the Ganucci, that were connected to the deaths of his family. I love the fact that they brought back the same actress to play Frank's wife from that series. That kind of continuity is important. We almost, again, didn't have it with Daredevil Born Again, but to continue those threads moving forward, to me at least, and a friend of mine had a similar sentiment, which was, I understand how important Frank's trauma is to him. Obviously, losing his family is a quite substantial thing to go through, but this at least feels like this is the end of sort of that era of Punisher, And what I'm really looking forward to, when I talked about this in Born Again, season two thoughts with Mike, and kind of what I've thought about what we've seen from Spider-Man Brand New Day, is it does feel like we're going into maybe Punisher version two. We get the new outfit at the end of this, as well as moving on with a new motivation and quite literally a purpose for life. That's the best part of this. Using his relationship to his family and like spend every moment he's at the grave. And it's just, look how great John Bernthal is. That stuff's incredible. And using the budget effectively to have meaningful supporting characters that quite frankly are barely in this. Like, they're in two notable scenes, but they carry most of the weight of the emotional center of the story.
Yeah. I mean, since we're in spoilers now, because it's always great seeing Curtis around. It's kind of interesting because they're very, very vague on where he is right now in the MCU since season two of Punisher. But with that said, I want to just talk about what I screamed the most about, which was Karen Page. Like, okay, so here's the thing. Anyone who's followed me on social media or followed my coverage of Daredevil and the MCU over the last 10 years, I'm going to make this very clear. I have never cared for Karen that much. I've never cared for Karen and Matt being a couple. However, she and Frank look at each other, breathe in the same room. They are just talking or just existing together. The shipper in me gets so f-ing emotional because Castle with a K is the end game I've been waiting for since Daredevil season two. And in just that one scene, Deborah and John crush it on so many levels. But again, Kyle was saying, this is, whether it's too long or it's too short, that is up for debate. But the fact was that scene was just so perfect, which makes me just want to see more. They need to end up together at some point. And it just, because they are so, somehow they make each other better in a lot of ways. And like I said, Karen has had her moments in Daredevil and Born Again. But again, I prefer her when she's in the Punisher side of the MCU. I think that's where she fits in better as a very complex moral ground for Frank, especially given that she has some darkness in her herself. And the fact that Frank was imagining her in his wife's hoodie, shirt, whatever it was, I'm like, if that's not ship ending game material, I don't know what is. And the fact is that one of the things I've always appreciated with Karen when it comes to Frank is that, we're living in an era right now where masculinity is talked about more than ever in TV and film. We're living in this time where some are saying that we are erasing true masculinity, which is ultra macho, ultra non-emotional, and just, look how tough I am. But the true test of a man is the fact that when a man can actually be vulnerable, wear his heart on his sleeve. And we see moments like that with his interaction with Karen of asking, are you really here? Are you really here? They almost kiss, and the fact that they almost kiss, I'm like, I don't care how they do it. Somehow bring John back into season three of Born Again and have them finally f-ing end up together. I am so done with the baiting, the constant baiting that the MCU has done. They need to be together. Matt and Karen never made sense. I vomit. I die. I want to just throw myself off a building. Like, whenever time I see them, like, oh my God, look, we love each other so much. I'm like, no, it's not believable whatsoever. And it's also a lot of ways a big ick, because the way that Matt and Karen met initially, was with Foggy, she was their client, and then they worked together, and now they're suddenly, I don't know, I just don't, I'm not here for Matt and Karen, but I'm here for Karen and Frank. And again, that was like one of the scenes I was rewatching on the loop with my screener of, like, I'm like, oh my God, he's so soft for her, I love this. And for all my fellow Castle girlies out there, you know what I'm talking about, and I hope you are just as happy but also frustrated as I am, because I feel that we're getting to a point where they need to actually commit to giving us Castle.
Well, I think that's an interesting point to jump off with, which is what's really fascinating narratively of where this fits is its evaluation is purely on a Frank that we don't necessarily get to see how he gets to this place, which I didn't like. Like, obviously, Frank is he's a machine, and obviously the tactician that he is in the way that he eviscerates mobsters or whoever it happens to be. I think what was fascinating about this was the choice to narratively set stuff up that feels tangentially connected, but obviously it's in a different part of New York, which did sort of fall in line with that. Yeah, but this is a part of New York. Like, this is clearly the summer. Like, I like this, but I think where I'm frustrated is I wanted to love it. All the Karen and Frank stuff is fantastic. And the way that they've explored that relationship as a whole, whether that be Matt's relationship with Karen now because of her relationship with Frank from the Netflix stuff, I like how that's carried forward. I don't have the same desire to see Frank and Karen together, unfortunately, Andy.
Well, you always have horrible taste in ships anyway, like anytime we talked. So
besides the point, we're not talking about the CW today, Andy. That's for another day. What I like so much about that sequence is narratively and thematically at the same time, what significance that serves in sort of getting Frank out of the funk that he's in. Because with this being a tight 47, you have to do a lot with very little. Like, the cast list for this is like 6 people, because that's pretty much all that it probably had the time and money for. And whether that be using Curtis and other Navy SEALs as essentially trauma shadows, being like, hey, remember us? Remember you did that thing? And the symbology in this is kind of over the top, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, where he's cutting his tattoo, right? Like, that's the death of what that meant to be one of those people. And then his relationship with the store owner and the little girl, and just using her effectively enough. And I don't think it's beating people over the head. Obviously, we know Frank had a daughter. He also had a son. There just didn't happen to be another child in this story, in this, where it's supposed to be Little Sicily. That's where it takes place. And in which he's created a power vacuum. And what that means is absolute chaos. I think what would have been really nice for this, and this is the continuity, ironically, and I know in saying this, police in me, is because this is New York, where is any of the cops, like the anti-vigilante task force or anything, because they don't seem to be present whatsoever. This does sort of feel ironic because it's New York in its own island continuity wise. Like, I don't need Daredevil King. I don't need that, because this is Frank's thing. But it is odd to me that he's not at all in Born Again season 2. He's not even referenced, I don't think, like, at all. We don't know what he's doing. There's not a BB report like, hey, did you hear about all those deaths in Little Sicily? Like, what's going on there? Or just sort of fitting it in where the timeline person to me is like, how do I watch these? I obviously, we know we're getting Brand New Day, and we'll get there later, because that is a different, he's a shaved Frank. He's got no more beard. The hand is going to be in that. And I've already talked about the connections that I think would be really interesting, because I would like to see what John Bernthal could bring to the possibility of a version 2 of the Punisher. So I'm not as high on this as you, which is not to say it's not great. It's, I wanted more, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
No, there's two parts of it. I mean, yes, it's definitely, if you feel that there is still room, more room to explore, then yeah, like, that can be definitely a criticism in itself. But also to say that it's a good thing, because that means that you're still invested in Frank to the point where you're willing to see him more again after this, whether it is in Brand New Day or where we see him next. I wanted to touch upon the timeline aspect, because this was something I did address in my review, because I had a little bit of a hiccup with it as well, because it is very ambiguous where this is taking place. It obviously has to be, like, we know it's at least after Born Again season 1, and given the context of Frank's psychology, I would have to figure that this is after Born Again season 2, because the fact that he's not in Born Again season 2 at all, it could speak to the fact that he was just trying to lay low, and that he is just trying to leave this life, you know, this part of his life behind. And that's why he didn't really get involved with everything that was happening between Daredevil and Kingpin. But also the fact that given the fact that there were no involvement with the anti-vigilante task force or things like that, I would have to assume that this is after Fisk step down from being the mayor, because there is no way that if he heard that Punisher was active somewhere around New York, that he wouldn't send a whole freaking army there to take him down. So this like in my mind, this is likely days, if not a week or two, after Born Again season 2, where it kind of can fit into the timeline of it all. Where, and again, like I said, we see it in story that the reason he is not really in Born Again season 2 is because this man was ready to end his life, which was, I think, one of the most powerful scenes of not just this presentation, but also Frank's trajectory in the whole MCU since he's been here. That, because I, you know, like, with Punisher, there's so many aspects that speak so much to real life things that people in his situation who have been in the service, who have been in the military or been a Marine or what have you, that they have dealt with, you know, that this is an extreme traumatized person with severe PTSD. And this was, you know, he felt that he had to get to this point of like, I had to end it. So I would say that's, you know, until I'm told otherwise, that's what I'm putting it at in the franchise terms of chronological order, where there's no way that this could have been happening at the same time as Born Again season 2, because Wilson would have sent the task force there immediately. Like it would not have escalated to that point of Frank getting away with killing so many people as he did without Mayor Fisk being like, you know, yeah, let's just ignore that and focus on Daredevil. Like, no, like that's the whole point of like why the city was shut down and yeah, like why there was no BB report. Like, yeah, I mean, again, I think they were limited on time and budget, because, you know, because that's also, you know, another actor you have to pay, another character you have to write in. And I think that we don't really, like, we get it. He killed people there. We don't need to hear her recap it. Like, we get it. So I feel like, because again, yeah, this is definitely also, this was also done as a way to kind of set him up to be in Brand New Day where it makes sense. Because if you had taken the Frank that we had at the end of Born Again season 1 and just thrown him right into Brand New Day, it never would have made sense to me. This is now a Frank that is, for lack of a better term, hopeful, brutally hopeful, I guess. Because again, like I was debating with one of my friends and colleagues the other day, where I think that the idea of one last kill, I think this is supposed to be a symbol of that he isn't going to be killing as many people, if any at all, anymore, because I think he's going to try. I think he has now a different viewpoint on life. I think he might also look at death as like an easy solution, where like, no, let me punish those, no pun intended, rather than just giving them the easy way out. So yeah, that's just how I look at it.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, just based on the setup of the main reason he sort of is reborn as the Punisher is because Ma Gnucci lets everyone know where he is, resulting in what's a very, I'm glad it's not a one-er, because I am done with one-ers. They've been done to death. But the way in which there's a gauntlet of thugs for him to fight through, reminding us the capabilities of Frank, at the same time showing why he is the Punisher and what makes him human. Because it's not a perfect, I got through everybody. Like, he gets his bruises, his cuts, he gets shot at one time.
He
was lit on fire. His CGI body double fell into an air vac. I'm just going to mention it. It looks bad. It's annoying that that's in a Marvel Studios thing. They released a photo of it today. I still don't understand how that shot got made. Does that ruin this for me? No. The MCU, it's almost a badge of honor to have a really badly CGI'd anything in your product. Look at all of Robert Downey Jr.'s head replacements in Civil War. That man is not in that suit, and you can tell. And so with that, I don't think this is the one last kill. I think it's the one last kill of this, which is, of course, of that thug we see in the beginning taking that gentleman's hat and killing his dog. And as we've learned with John Wick, he deserves to die because he killed the dog. But Ma Gnucci's still out there. Like, is that going to be the thread carried forward where Frank's on a mission now? Like, hey, I had this thing that happened and I realized I still need to be the Punisher, because there are people, to use your pun as well, people that need to be punished. Maybe Spider-Man being Spider-Man stops him from killing people. That's a very Peter thing when he interacts with the Punisher. but we also know the Hand is going to be involved in that film. So there's a lot of Daredevil connections in Spider-Man Brand New Day, where they luckily have dodged all of the Wilson stuff, which is odd because, again, Sony owns the theatrical rights to Kingpin. So if they wanted to include him, Sony could. Marvel's not been able to because Marvel doesn't own the theatrical rights. All of that just to say, agree, guys, so Vincent can get into a movie, because you let Charlie do it. I mean, Marvel technically let Sony do it, but let's have Kingpin and Daredevil theatrically. There's an article I read today that connects to this, which is the Jack Ryan Ghost Wars streaming movie is a test for building up a fan base and then making just a straight movie as opposed to just another season of television. The irony is Disney is doing the opposite, which is making a great season of television, making two worse seasons of television, and then reworking a fourth season of television into a movie that nobody wants to see. Where on the opposite side of that, I would really love for them to make a cinematic Daredevil, because that is a character who deserves that. And you could have this cast of characters that we love. You could have Frank in it just for an incredible moment. Maybe tease Castle on, again, I don't necessarily want that. But in terms of what it does in serving Frank's story, I would be curious if you agree or disagree with me. Like, do you think this sort of puts a cap on going back to the well of his family? Or because Magunuchi's not dead, maybe we get back to that again?
I think that it's definitely putting the cap on the family trauma aspect for him. I think that it's gonna be an essential part of him going forward, but it's not gonna be something that keeps being showcased in the way that we've seen over the last 10 years with him. And with Magunuchi, and like, first of all, like a shout out to Judy Life, you know, even though she only had maybe like 2 or 3 scenes, like, she was chilling as Magunuchi. Like, I, like, it's not a character I am very familiar from the comics, but just how ruthless she was and, you know, cold she was really, really something. I don't necessarily think that it's a story they're going to keep going back to, because I think in his mind, he feels that she's lost everyone. She is in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. What else can I do other than just end her? Because someone who leads a crime family, she probably has corrupted lawyers and, you know, connections in the world of the law where she can get out of prison anytime. So I think for him, he's like, she is punished, and the best punishment for her is to be alive and not have her family and that type of power anymore that she used to maybe. In terms of the other stuff, when it comes to like bringing these characters to the big screen, I think that I don't know if a Daredevil movie is going to happen anytime soon. I do agree that, you know, we need to get Vincent's Kingpin into an MCU movie before he, because I didn't notice until last week, Vincent is 66. And I'm like, first of all, he does not look like it. He looks like way younger than that. But secondly, with the fact that he is 66, Marvel Studios can only use him for so much longer until he physically can't do that role anymore. Because again, like the fact that he talked about it very recently, even that he can't keep putting on that weight anymore. You know, now they're using a muscle suit, which I am fully in support of, because even though I am against the idea of fat suits, because I think it's just a parody of the fact that, you know, hey, like, and someone who has been overweight and who is fat, that's not a costume. That is our lives. That's not something you can just put on and just take off whenever you want. And a lot of times in Hollywood, they're made so poorly. But the fact that they made it as a muscle suit, where like it, you know, you can't really hear when he's moving. Like, it feels like that is his body. And I think the season finale, Born Again, was a good testament, because he doesn't look cheesy. It doesn't look like it looks like a person who is that actual big. And that's why, like, but if you're gonna put someone else in that suit that is a stunt double, whenever Vincent can do those action scenes anymore, like, that can be a big risk. So that's why Sony Marvel worked this out somehow and get this done while he still can. And in terms of like having there, I think that if anything, I think a street level MCU movie with these characters is where we could head in the future. Like, maybe somehow like we reboot the Defenders for the big screen. Cause I just don't really think a Daredevil movie is gonna happen, because I think Marvel is gonna focus now on their bigger hero titles in Phase 7 and beyond, like X-Men, Spider-Man sequels, Fantastic Four sequels, Avengers sequels, and what have you. And I think with Daredevil, like, I think he should definitely be a leading character for a movie. And I think doing it with, like, a Defenders type of film would be the most logical sense. And I think if, depending on how Punisher is received in Brand New Day, there's a possibility that we could get that down the line where, like, there is some sort of, like, maybe secret Avengers or something like that. Because we know that the MCU, like, whenever they take titles or concepts from the comics, it is almost never like it is from the comics. It's always revamped in one way or the other. Like, for example, the new Avengers that we have for Thunderbolts, it is not at all what it is in the comics. It's just a perfect opportunity for them to use that name for what they need in the MCU franchise.
Yeah, I think that's it's a great place to kind of wrap up our thoughts on this. It's funny that the evaluation of this is obviously specifically looking at what the Punisher presents, but it is such a fascinating place just for the MCU in general, where we have the least amount of projects coming up. I know I saw a lot of conversation about that within this last week. We don't know if we're going to be getting any other special presentations with any main characters. All the shows that we're getting are essentially continuations of stuff that we've had already, which is fascinating. We know Daredevil Born Again Season 3 is coming, which is obviously going to include all of the Defenders. I mean, I would hope Jessica Hennick pops up, and maybe that can be a wonderful surprise for me. I don't know, because she is also one of the Iron Fists now. But I think that kind of wraps up our thoughts on the Punisher One Last Kill. Andy, do you have any other final thoughts on the special presentation?
I need Castle.
There are 37 of us left. Barely a whisper of who we once were. But still more than enough to tear this planet in half.
On to Invincible Season 4. So I gave my non-spoiler thoughts on the season, but overall, I thought this season worked really well. The obvious elephant in the room is the animation, which is becoming more and more frustrating when we see the other projects that Prime Video is putting out, whether that be The Mighty Nine, The Legend of Vox Machina, Batman Caped Crusader. I would even say, to some degree, Has Been Hotel Season 2 had better animation, but overall, it isn't as distracting as it has been in the past. The story for this season was really interesting to me. Again, Scotty, I love you, buddy. I will never read the comics. I don't ever plan on reading the comics. This season as a whole is really the end on what I guess you could classify as phase one of Invincible, with the Viltrumite conflict or war coming to an end. And specifically with the finale, what I loved so much about this final episode, because that's where most of the meat is, and the battles and stuff are really interesting in the aftermath of what Mark has to do, and I will get there in a minute. But with Mark and Threg in, I guess not space, but floating in the upper atmosphere of the Earth, having that conversation, and the traumatic thing that he had to do with Nolan and Alan, destroying Viltrum, and what that could do ultimately to make Earth the target for all the Viltrumites, you get him seeing all of these violent moments, which of course has become an expectation within Invincible as a whole. That's what made the first season so notable, the Nolan destruction at the end of that first season. But this episode, it gives you all of that violence, but it's not actually anything that's happening. It's just the anxiety that Mark has because of what they did. So you get that Invincible itch scratched, but this is much more about the emotional place that Mark is, as well as where we are now narratively within this story. You are expecting a cataclysmic event on Earth because of the destruction of Viltrum. And you don't get that. You get purely looking at the relationships and how they've evolved because of what's happened in this show. On top of that, you get an ending to the Viltrumite War, which I was not expecting at all. And what made it such a pleasant surprise is it comes purely from strategy. How do we actually defeat the Viltrumites when we've seen, specifically with Threg, the threat that he is? And that there's no possible way where our current characters are that they would be able to defeat him. And they don't. They've lost that part of the war, but the overall conclusion, and I would guess it's an amnesty, a resolution, a ceasefire has been reached where Threg threatens the destruction of Earth And the solution that he's willing to provide is we live here and we repopulate and eventually we leave, but nothing bad will happen. We won't interfere with anything that has to do with any of the humanity or humans, whatever conflicts arise, we're going to stay out of that. And that's a really interesting place to put Mark, knowing that humanity is safe, but at the same time, the dreaded threat of the universe is kind of pushed to the side just for the sake of Earth. While this was a galactic conflict and everything, we had the United Nations of Planets. I know that's not what it's called, but you have a solution of unease and the tension between Thrag and Mark, and you can see the anger building into the character as he's trying to come up with what he's going to do. And spending the whole episode having Mark think about what he's afraid could happen, what could have happened, his relationship with Eve and the way that they address the pregnancy and the abortion that happens because of Eve's fear for the future. And you get a lot of really great adult conversations between a number of the characters, whether that be Mark's conversations with Thrag or Debbie talking to Nolan. All of these relationships have changed so dramatically throughout this show. And this is one of the aspects that's the most entertaining, is we're not doing bottom of the barrel conversations where it's just, here's where I am now, here's where you are. We've seen an evolution in who these people are and how their dynamics have changed. And season four, for me, is the most entertaining because I have expectations and the brutality is still there. You don't necessarily know if anybody is going to live or die, but you deliver that while also having so much payoff for what we've expected from this Viltrumite war. You get the incredible action sequences. You do get a lot of floating PNGs. But overall, where this puts Mark as the defender of the planet in an uneasy situation, there has been a resolution, but what is going to happen after that? Where this is the great thing about storied television, you have had serialized stories throughout the entire series that have built to this, and this does feel like this chapter of the book is ending and we're going to be building to something else. What is that jumping off point going to be? I don't necessarily know. We obviously had a couple of one-offs that really add in elements that I'm sure we're going to be exploring later, whether that be Robot being somewhere else in the galaxy. We went back to Hell, but the conflict of the Viltrumites, at least for now, has been put to bed. And I'm very curious on what we get moving forward, because I don't know what the overarching threat's going to be. And my curiosity is a good thing. I don't necessarily want to be able to guess where everything is going. As a viewer, that's not entertaining. You want to be surprised. And what works so well about Invincible, that I had issues with another Robert Kirkman show, is it's not just cliffhanger, cliffhanger, cliffhanger. At the end of the day, it's how does this build into this mosaic with all these different stories connecting into a larger picture? And for the most part, they've really done that. There are the episodes here and there where, not being a comic book fan, I don't understand the significance, but for the most part, those things wind up being important and the show delivers that. I like Invincible a lot. I know that they've said how long they want this show to run, and I'd be very curious on seeing where that does go. I have no idea, but Invincible Season 4 delivered on all of my expectations, and where it sets the characters moving forward automatically puts them in entirely new situations, which as a viewer four seasons in, you have to deliver that. Kirkman has worked on cable television. So many other showrunners haven't. Kripke being another one. They understand how you deliver the story week after week. And this is a weekly show. I like the way that it does that because it lets you sit with each episode. And Prime Video, whether that being dropping three at a time to sort of sink your teeth into the overall story and then getting you to see what happens week to week, is a great delivery. If you're a fan of Invincible, this might be my favorite season. And as a jumping off point, halfway through the show, I believe they've said they want to go about eight. This is a great conclusion to the Viltrumite War, and I'm really looking forward to whatever the future conflict is. So that will do it for my full spoiler thoughts on Invincible Season 4. It may not have been as in-depth as you were hoping for, but the real meat of this season was Episode 7 and 8. So that's my my full spoiler thoughts on Invincible Season 4.
Tonight at 11.
Doom! We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves, you might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
On to the news of the week, which I'm really enjoying that intro. I hope our listeners are as well. So we have really three main things to talk about this week. The first is how Lanterns gave DC a space cop show with dueling timelines. Now, this to me was maybe the most obvious thing they were going to do with this series, which was when it was pitched to us back in 2024, whenever that James Gunn press conference was or announcement, when they outlined Chapter 1, Gods and Monsters, is we were going to get a True Detective-style Green Lantern show. If you have watched True Detective, you know that it is dueling timelines. The reason I'm most excited for this is this allows the show the opportunity specifically to show two varied versions of Hal Jordan. We're not just getting introduced to him as the mentor. We're seeing Hal work independently on his own. And then in the more present part of the timeline, we're seeing that mentor-mentee relationship that a lot of the trailers have insinuated is going to be the focus. That is a great idea because as we explore the DC universe, you want to understand the history. One of the coolest parts of Superman was it outlined that Superman is not the only metahuman within the world. We've had 3,000 years of metahumans existing, which means there are countless stories that have happened already off screen. Now, are we going to explore all of those in depth? No. We do know that Clayface will actually predate the events of everything we've seen so far because James Gunn did say that the Clayface in the film is the same Clayface that we saw from Creature Commandos, which is not necessarily something that's super important because at the end of the day, I like to think of, shout out to James for this, but the tiers of canonicity, if something is live action, that is the highest tier, followed by animation and then potentially video games or any other expanded media. So that connection is nice. It's cool to know. But overall, as a diehard Green Lantern fan, I'm really looking forward to seeing what is Hal Jordan near the end of his prime. Because obviously we see in the trailer we've seen so far that he's an older veteran. How does he approach things when he's working individually on his own? And then how does he approach things when he is a mentor? And seeing if this Jon Stewart character is worthy of the ring that the Guardians have chose for him. That's really cool. I love Green Lanterns. And what's so fantastic about this show is that it was conceived as featuring more than one Green Lantern. While everybody has their favorite Green Lantern, the show is giving us at least two. And the comics have had so many where you might be of a certain generation where you love Alan Scott, Hal Jordan, Jon Stewart, Kyle Rayner, Jessica Cruz. There have been so many. And the fact that this show is already introducing us to two and potentially the larger world of the Lantern Corps, that's awesome. And it also does say that there were plans for this to be a series as opposed to a one-off show, which is a great way to introduce the general public to the Lanterns as an idea. And then if you want to do something incredibly grand, such as the Core War or having the spectrums, because we know that Sinestro's been teased already. There are other Lantern Corps. What could that mean? That would be something that I would really want to see, and you would only be able to do that on the big screen. So that makes me really excited. Matt Reeves decided to slowly go through Twitter this week and confirm all the major cast members. Now, obviously, we knew Robert Pattinson was going to be back. They had sort of announced that Sebastian Stan was going to be in the film. Now, there are rumors that he's not playing Harvey Dent. Personally, I don't really think that makes any sense, specifically on who the next two cast members were, which is Scarlett Johansson as Gilda Dent, and then Charles Dance as Christopher Dent. What I think is really interesting, and a lot of people have had this idea as well, why introduce Charles Dent? Well, we know in the first The Batman, they talked a lot about the history of the Waynes and the Arkhams. Now, Gotham, outside of Bruce Wayne, has a quite illustrious founding families. And what do they mean to the significance of the story? A lot of people would love Court of Owls. I would as well. I think it's a fantastic, maybe the best storyline we got in the DC New 52 from Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. So that was really cool to see them finally outlined. And the GIF that Matt Reeves shared of Sebastian Stan, I don't know what that's from, but Harvey Dent is so much more than Two-Face. If you've read The Long Halloween or even watched Batman the Animated Series, where we see the significance of Harvey's relationship with Bruce as well as Batman and what he meant for Gotham City and why the downfall of him becoming Two-Face is so tragic is something I hope that we explore. And his relationship with Gilda, that is obviously heavily connected to The Long Halloween, something a lot of people know that Matt Reeves loves. And then we got a bunch of cast members. We don't know what they're going to be. Sebastian, I believe it's Cock. That would be my guess. If it's Coach, I'm not necessarily sure. I'm not familiar with him as an actor. A lot of people are thinking there's a possibility he could be playing Arkham or Mr. Freeze. I lean on the side that I don't think we're going to be getting Mr. Freeze. The world that Matt Reeves created for The Batman Part 1 just doesn't feel like a place where Mr. Freeze would exist. You can have the crazy killers and maniacs, but that level of, I would say, comic book supernatural ability, I guess it's more in the science fiction realm actually, doesn't really make sense. I don't know who that could be, but I'm excited to see who it is. How is this story that everybody who's read it says it's absolutely incredible? What is this mystery? We know Matt Reeves is telling another mystery, and I'm very curious to seeing how each of these characters is going to be a part of that story. The next one that I hope this rumor is true, Brian Tyree Henry is going to be in it from The Eternals. He obviously is the voice of Miles Morales' dad in the Spider-Verse films. Man, he would be an absolutely perfect Harvey Dent. I hope that is the case. Seeing Brian Tyree Henry bounce back and forth with Jeffrey Wright, I need that. I need that movie now. I know we have to wait over a year for the film, but yes, I would absolutely love for that to be the case. If we are doing another procedural, and that's not a criticism of that style, but a murder mystery, are we going to see how the police are more involved with Batman? And in doing so, are we going to be getting more characters from Gotham PD? That's something that I think would be really great to see, because if you grew up with Batman the Animated Series, so many of the police within the Gotham PD are just as interesting as some of the villains or other supporting characters. Speaking of Gotham as a world, we know that Jamie Lawson is going to be back as Bella Real, the mayor, and Gil Perez Abraham will be back as Officer Martinez. I love that the supporting characters were so significant to the narrative of the original film that it would be sad to sort of have them just not there at all. There is a fair assumption that Bruce Wayne is going to be much more of a public figure in this film. It would only make sense for that to be the case after the events of the first Batman. Batman is now a symbol for hope. If more people are going to be curious as to what Batman is or who Batman is, you would need to have Bruce Wayne be in the public eye so that there would not be an assumption that this rich guy that we never see and is very, very pale could be spending his billions of dollars on being a superhero who fights crime. So I'm very excited to see, I've said that a lot, and this is probably not shocking to anybody, but The Batman Part 2 is my most anticipated film of 2027. I don't see anything succeeding that. Getting to see Robert Pattinson be the Batman that he was, but be the public-facing Bruce Wayne. We haven't seen that from him in this series, but we know that Robert Pattinson is capable of being the gentleman, the playboy. That's a version of Bruce Wayne that everybody's familiar with, and I want to see Robert Pattinson's take on that. In terms of other supporting characters, Andy Serkis is finally confirmed to be back as Alfred. He's Matt Reeves' guy. He was Caesar in the Planet of the Apes trilogy. And that dynamic between Alfred and Robert's Bruce is very much in line with, I would say, much more like the Batman Earth One narrative. And those moments with those characters, specifically in the first film, I mean, it would be only in the first film, the hospital scene and Bruce really understanding that while his family is gone, he still has Alfred and somebody who matters to him so greatly. Those scenes were great. And I'm glad Andy is able to fit Alfred into his insanely busy schedule because, you know, he's making a Lord of the Rings film. That's quite the undertaking as the director and star, because he is Gollum. And somebody who is probably should be on the Mount Rushmore for live action Batman villains will be back. Colin Farrell will be the Penguin. I don't care if it's one scene, but after watching the Penguin, Colin Farrell is the definitive Penguin and a definitive Batman villain. I want any time we can have with him. If it is just as iconic as him being tied up and translating Spanish for Batman and Jim Gordon, that's all I need. And I think that's really cool that a character so iconic as Colin's Penguin will be back, especially after the events of the series. I'm not going to spoil that here, but where is Penguin's headspace as the mob boss that we all know him to be? Last piece of news before we round out the episode in listener mail. James Bond casting has officially started. This is exciting. So many people are going to have their ideas of who it's going to be. It is a safe assumption. It is likely somebody in their late 20s, early 30s, given how much these films take to get made, the length of time between films. It'll be very interesting to seeing if Amazon/MGM manages to get more than the last run of Daniel Craig films, which was, I believe, 5 films in the span of, what would it have been, 15 years? Now, every 3 years is not the worst thing for a major franchise. What is most important is you cast the right actor for the role and you manage to make each of the Bond films events. There are actors that I would have liked to have seen in this role. I don't think that they are going to be in the running at all. They're just too old because this process has taken a really long time. I do love the idea of going back to the 60s. I think that's where Bond is best. I trust all of the creative people involved with this. Denis Villeneuve as a director, obviously I love his work so much. And the fact that he wants to make this movie while it is also being written by Steven Knight, that's exciting is a word I've obviously used a fair amount with this news segment, but there's so much interesting stuff happening, and where the Bond franchise could be going is unlike anything we've really seen from before. It's obviously being looked at as a brand, but what MGM cannot afford to do is dilute that brand. We have seen with Disney Plus on the dilution of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well as Star Wars that the event nature of those products is no longer felt that way. Mandalorian and Grogu is coming out next week, and the hype is just not where it used to be behind Star Wars films. Even after the mixed reception by fans to The Last Jedi, Rise of Skywalker was still a cinematic event. It was the final film in the Skywalker saga. James Bond needs to be, it won't be Star Wars, but it needs to drive people to want to go to theaters. Getting one of the best directors of all time. I'm saying that with Denis Villeneuve working on it. He will be coming off of Dune Part 3, which I only expect to love. That's awesome. I'm hoping we get this by 2028. That would be the hope, but I don't know. When we get the new Bond, I'm sure it's going to be a massive event on social media, just like it has been for every James Bond, as long as social media has existed. There's always a conversation about if they cast the right actor, just like when they cast Batman. That will do it for news. Now let's jump to listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what is your favorite season of TV so far in 2026? Dylan Pollock wrote in, I think so far it's Invincible season 4. It was excellent. But also, I love to see how Hacks wraps it up, which it could be as well. Strong honorable mention to Shrinking season 3 and Neighbors was absolutely bonkers as well. I love Shrinking so much. That show makes me laugh. That show makes me cry. And it has Harrison Ford and Michael J. Fox. What could you not love more about it? Scotty Cameron writes in, I can tell Kyle hasn't played many of the Mortal Kombat games. Scotty, how could you tell? Because I didn't know who Smoke was. Yes, obviously that's the case. Especially the more recent ones. Smoke was a hidden character in the first two games. It was? Oh. And he made his proper debut in Mortal Kombat 3. He's a robot ninja. I thought that was someone else. But no, apparently not. He's also paired in with Noob in Deception. He's in MK9 and MK1 from 2023. And Scotty, not surprisingly, is a huge Invincible fan and says that was his favorite season of TV so far this year. He loved the change of pace with the big battles in the penultimate and the finale. And he also loved Daredevil Born Again Season 2. He just started The Boys. There's been a lot of great TV this year. A lot of it's continuations, but I don't necessarily think that's bad. Andy, do you have a favorite season of TV so far this year?
From this year? I would say it is. It's tough because there's been, I would say, I don't have a favorite specifically, but some shadows I do want to give is Scrubs season 10. Scrubs is back. It's going to come back for another season. And I am so happy that this revival is doing what a good revival should do. We don't talk about season 9 of Scrubs. If you know, you know. And also Abbott Elementary had a wonderful season. And this fifth season was very, very strong. I think Quinta just continues to just push the envelope of what you can do with a show like Abbott. And where it doesn't feel like they're just repeating the same things over and over and over again. And I look forward to see what next season has in store. And I really did love Born Again Season 2. Like, I have a lot of issues with Born Again Season 2. Not for the same reason I had issues with Season 1, where, like, you can tell this was two different shows being forced into one. But I think with Season 2 of Born Again, I think that we're finally going to a new direction with Daredevil and also Kingpin. In the third season, and I'm definitely curious to see how season 2 of Born Again will compare to something like Vision Quest that is coming out at the end in the middle of October from Marvel Studios, and so that's gonna be interesting. But also, like, I at the time of recording, you know, we're like days away from the series finale of The Boys. I'm really enjoying season 5. Like, I don't know what issues people have with it, but I think it's a solid final season so far.
Yeah, there's been a lot of great stuff, but people would be curious, based on what last week's question of the week is, what is this week's question of the week? Which goes in line with the conversation we've had already. What Disney Plus series would you like to see get a feature film on the big screen? So to answer that question of the week, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com. You can also answer directly on YouTube and Spotify, or you can hashtag QOTW to any of the Film Realist social media. If you're watching this podcast on YouTube, please like and subscribe. And if you're not following, make sure you do so, because next week's episode will be my review of The Mandalorian and Grogu, the Disney Plus series that is now a movie. Andy, thank you so much for coming back to the podcast.
Thank you.
You can see Andy working on Screen Rant, as well as several things on the Multiverse of Color. There might be something fun coming up into the works for DC Studios, but you're going to have to make sure you subscribe there as well so you don't miss it. My name is Kyle Naranja, and I will see you next time.